2, Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You will also hear Mel. He's Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick attempt to organize this enthusiastic group that meets most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and how to get more enjoyment out of it, and how to understand how all this hardware works. What's Mother Nature really telling us? I think there was a flea market at the Hall of Science today, so I imagine somebody will be giving us some feedback as to how that went. They certainly had good weather. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. We recommend that most of the people who sign in be the people who really do have a question or a comment. The fact that you're listening, we sort of expect that after 28 years. This is TechNet number 1,317 that meet almost every single Sunday since September of 1982. So by now we sort of accept the fact that there are people listening in the tri-state area. The good news is that northern New Jersey and southwestern Connecticut and southern New York and Long Island, in that area around New York City, there's quite a bit of brain power. And the people who sign into the TechNet with their questions, and that's the subject of the discussion, is usually set by the people who sign in with a question. Rarely do Mel and I have a subject that we start off with, so to speak. So a person, by giving us his call letters, his name, because I'm so darn forgetful, we signed up. We come back to the people in the order in which they sign in, with a couple of exceptions. John and Wesley are involved in an ongoing and
repeater timeout cancel.
And there's something that we're supposed to do every minute and a half or so. We're supposed to give an interruption, wait for the beep, and wait 1 or 2 seconds beyond the beep in order for the whole network to be reset. As I was starting to say, John, KC2WGB, and Wesley N2XJN are involved in an ongoing investigation of what a very strong neodymium magnet and similar things are able to do. And they've been gathering quite a bit of test equipment. We've already got those two guys signed in. Anyone else to sign in tonight with the question or a comment, please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes at this time, K2RIW.
2EO, Dick, November 2, Echo Oscar, with a question about 10 gigahertz.
KC2WIQ, yes.
KC2RFN, yes.
WS2N, Paul. What's the space report? Good evening, Dick.
So far we've got Rich, WIQ or WYQ, I'm not sure which. WIQ or WYQ, please correct me on your call letters and tell me your name. We've also got Alan and Paul. WYQ, go right ahead with your full call letters and name, sir.
KC2WIQ, my name is Michael.
Okay, Mike. So we've got Mike, Alan, Rich, already signed in as John, Wesley, and Paul with a space report and maybe a question. Anyone else to sign in with a question or comment, please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. K2RIW listening.
Good evening, all.
K2KEY. And to RDB, no questions, just supporting the net.
Okay, we recognize Mel and RDB. Anyone else to check in with a question or comment? One last call. Give me your call letters and name at this time.
November 2, Delta Queen India. Name is Paul.
Okay, Paul. Alrighty. Give us a little bit of a rundown. Whether or not we go to Wesley or John first, it's your call, Wesley. I'm guessing you were at the Hall of Science flea market today. At least I think there was one today. If I know you, probably saw some very interesting pieces of test equipment. What's the latest in your neighborhood? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, everybody. N2XJN. Yes, we were, and we've got a lot of stuff. John and I, we have actually similar questions. I have the question that could wait till later, how to measure the resonance. of the ferrite by itself. Ferrite is lossy material, so it is being used to amplify increase the inductance of the coil. But does the ferrite by itself change the frequency? And also, at a certain frequency, the ferrite amplifies better and less. So that's one of the questions. And the second question is related to John, and if you let John just to give you the question, then you will decide which question to pick up and to address.
Go right ahead, John.
AC2WGV. Good evening, Dick, Bill. Thank you for taking the question. Let me let it drop. Okay. Wesley recently acquired a Fluke calibration amplifier, which is used to extend the application of the little handheld and small portable calibrators. It has a gain of 100. It has a frequency range up to, it's accurate to 120 kilohertz. So if you put 2 volts in, you'll get 200 volts out, whether it's DC positive or negative, or a square wave or a sine wave. We have a question regarding the output. I have to let it drop one more time. We found this unit to be in great shape, and it works wonderful, and it's fairly accurate. The DC works perfectly. We put a 1.5 volt battery into it, and we'll have 150 volt output. Works beautiful, perfect. It's automatic current limiting. Whatever the load is on it, it has an automatic protection circuit, which is not adjustable. But we found that if we put a square wave into it, if we don't set the DC offset, the slew rate going above and below the zero point confuses the DC output or the AC output, and it either goes into overload or we just can't get the correct voltage out of it. So if we put a 10 volt square wave into it and we offset it by 5 volts so that the entire wave is on the DC side positive, it works perfectly. The only thing Wesley wants to know is that output now has a DC component. Is there a way or a style of capacitors we could put on that output to sort of preserve the wave and yet isolate the DC? We'd like your input on that. And if you can't handle that before Mel, that's fine.
Also, the addition to that question is that this master is heavier than my wife. My wife is around 100 pounds, maybe less. And this master is 130 pounds, maybe 140. And it contains 5 ceramic tubes. It's absolutely amazingly nice build, and the model number for that is 5205A. 5205A Precision Power Amplifier from Fluke. The maximum voltage is 1100 volts. It's supposed to work on 120, where it goes to 100 megahertz, to 1 megahertz without any problem.
Wesley, earlier John thought that it had a frequency response up to 120 kilohertz, and you just said now 100 megahertz. I wonder which it is. Over to you first, Wesley.
That was the guaranteed accurate frequency. The accuracy is not guaranteed over 120 kilohertz, but it did perform.
Okay, that makes more sense. Let me drop. Okay, I'm going to give a thumbnail sketch on each one of these, what little I know, and we'll be coming back to it later on. In the case of a coil of wire, I could wind my coil like a solenoid, or I could wind it as a flat coil, where almost all of the turns have the exact same diameter. There's various ways you can wind a coil of wire. And if you go to the appropriate page in the radio amateur's handbook, where you know the dimensions of the coil, the diameter of the diameter of the winding, the length of the coil, or the spacing between the turns, the number of turns, there's a formula in there which will give you a fairly good estimate as to how many microhenry you will get out of that particular coil. Drop. So that's a coil in air. if I now add iron-like materials into the axis of the coil, if I slipped a piece of a nail, for instance, if I was working at a very low frequency with no significant eddy current, or if I put laminations like a transformer, or if I put ferrite material, as I put material in the center of the coil, the magnetic field is able to flow through the ferrite or iron-like materials much more easily than it does flow through air. So as I add more and more iron, and as I close the loop of the iron around the coil, the magnetic field forms more easily, and that's a fancy way of saying that the apparent inductance, the real inductance of the coil increases. So as I add the right kind of materials to a coil, I can increase the inductance. You can also go the other way. I could put a brass slug in the middle of the coil. The brass slug is a non-iron material. It doesn't favor magnetic field. However, it does create eddy currents. In other words, I could, around that slug of brass, with my felt tip pen, I could draw a circle around the perimeter of the slug as if it was a circle of wire. And I could say that because the brass is a conductive material, the circle of wire acts like a short circuit. Let me drop. And once you put short-circuited turns anywhere in the vicinity of a coil, you decrease the inductance. So one of the experiments that many guys back in the old days used to do with IF cans, where there really was an air space down the middle of the IF can where you could put a ferrite slug, which was on the end of this tuning tool. The tuning tool was usually a yellow rod, and on one end there was a brass slug, and the other end there was a chunk of ferrite. As you plugged in the ferrite into the middle of the IF can, you increased the inductance, you lowered the resonant frequency of that particular coil, or if you plugged, unplugged the ferrite end of the tuning tool and plugged in the end that had the brass plug, you would be decreasing the inductance of the coil, moving it up in frequency. So you could, with this tuning tool, just by putting it in the middle of a coil, make the reactance of a coil increase or decrease, which respectively would lower the frequency or raise the frequency. So ferrite itself, the brass slug itself, has no real resonance per se. Yes, depending on the way it was manufactured, let's talk about the ferrite, depending on the way it was manufactured, what is the mu of the material, how fine are the grains, how much air space or glue space there is between the individual grains at the microscopic level. Let me drop. Each piece of ferrite material, if you go to the manufacturer, they will tell you that it gives you the best performance at this particular frequency region. A particular ferrite material I could pick up might have a very desirable response at 100 megacycles and lower. Usually lower is not a problem, but if I was using material that was intended for 100 megacycle region, and I decided to use it 1,000 megacycles instead. I've got 1,000 megacycle resonating coil, and I put this 100 megacycle ideal ferrite material into my 1,000 megacycle coil. What I'll discover is that I'll get a lot more loss. In other words, in order to make ferrite material work at higher and higher frequencies, you've got to make the grains smaller and smaller, microscopically speaking, so if there's less and less eddy current, that really means that there's a greater and greater percentage of air space around all of those grains. Therefore, the mu of the material goes down. What does mu mean? Let me drop. When they tell you the mu factor for ferrite material, that's really telling you how much better a magnetic field will go through that material by comparison to air. Air is considered to have a mu factor of 1 unity, and my 100 megacycle material might have a mu factor of, let's say, 25. If I put the right kind of physical arrangement of that mu of 25 ferrite material around my coil, whatever inductance my coil had before, it now will be approximately 25 times greater in inductance. If it was a 1 microhenry coil before, I put in this mu 25 material, I now have a 25 microhenry coil. The ferrite itself doesn't really have a resonance. You use it as the slug, so to speak, or the magnetic material around the coil The coil has some amount of inductance. Quite often we put a capacitor across it. The coil in the capacitor is the real resonator. But I can change the inductance of the coil by putting in the ferrite material, and therefore I get, in most cases, a lower frequency or a more compact coil because I'm using the ferrite. So the ferrite itself doesn't really have a resonance, but it has a desirable frequency region in which it gives you the best performance. You can go lower than that frequency if you desire. Usually there's no problem. You go much higher in frequency, usually you start getting a lot more loss. If I chose material that was intended for ferrite material intended for 1,000 megacycles, let me drop. Most likely that material will have a mu factor that is much, much lower. It would be nice if I could pick up mu material 100, and I could do that at, say, for instance, 1 megacycle. I could probably find material that has a mu of 100 and works very well at 1 megacycle. If I choose material that is known to have reasonable performance at 1,000 megacycles, most likely its Q is going to be a much, much lower number, maybe something like 3 or 5, because the grains are far much smaller and there's more air spaces around those grains in order to manufacture that material. So that's a little bit about what I know about ferrite materials. I'll give a little bit of a thumbnail sketch about this Fluke amplifier, the 5205A. When I get a chance, I'm going to look that up. From the way you're describing this amplifier, although it's called a precision high-power amplifier, I think it really is the first cousin of a tube version of an operational amplifier. Let me drop.
Quick question on the ferrite.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Dick, a question on the ferrite. Would a gridded meter or dip meter give you the basic operating parameters or the best area to operate the ferrite if it was, say, a toroid? Would that reveal anything, and would that be a usable piece of information?
The way a grid dip meter works is that if I have a coil that is primarily an open frame resonator of some kind, I've got a coil of wire, I've got a capacitor across it, I bring my grid dip meter near it. When the grid dip meter is oscillating at the frequency where my coil and capacitor resonate, and I bring the two close together, the magic of resonance is that it will suck energy out of a nearby circuit that is operating at that frequency. So by bringing my grid dip meter near this coil, let's assume that I've got a coil and a capacitor that does resonate at 100 megacycles, and I've got my grid dip meter set at 100 megacycles, and I bring it near the coil will suck energy out of the coil that's part of the grid dip meter. The meter on the grid dip meter is showing me the magnitude of the amplitude of its oscillation, because energy is being sucked out. The needle moves to the left, that's the grid dip, and by scooting the frequency back and forth on the dial of the grid dip meter, I can tune for the greatest dip, and therefore I can find the resonant frequency of my inductor capacitor external circuit thing. If I'm using a real good toroid, I've got a problem. The nice thing about a toroid is that it's an extremely efficient closed magnetic field circuit. That's the good news. The bad news is now much more difficult to couple a grid dip meter to it. I think you can still do it, but the resonance detection capability of a grid dip meter on a toroid is going to be more difficult. There's probably ways of doing it by putting another sampling coil around your toroid. Let me drop. And now bring your grid dip meter near that sampling coil. I think that's a way of doing an operation. I wonder if you've done some measurements on ferrite toroids with a grid dip meter, Mel. Give us your experience on this one. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I had faced a similar situation some years ago where we had to identify unknown toroids at their MU and permeability. Now, there was a very interesting article, in fact, that was printed, and it was called a toroid tester. It actually was to test a toroid, an unknown core. You inserted an unknown core into this little contraption, and you were able to actually get the characteristics of this core. In other words, what was its mix? Very clever how it was done, Dick. And I found that it did solve the problem. This was what it was specifically designed for testing unknown toroids or known even toroids that you had that were known to test the accuracy of the material that was, in other words, the quality of the material that was put together over.
I wonder if that thing looked like a clamp-on ammeter, Mel. Were there jaws that opened up that would go through the center of the hole of the toroid when you were making that measurement? And give a little bit more weight that I didn't do. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. No, it was a very interesting little device. It was, it looked like, how do I say, like a cylinder. Yeah, I guess that's the best way to describe it. Like a bell jar made out of brass, I think. Something of that sort. It had a shaft in it. And with like a little platform in there, and you actually set the core in, and you close the thing up, and in the bottom it had a couple of contacts. I'm trying to describe it. I think I could find it maybe in a file. Where, I don't know, but I'll look in my file as to the exact way it was. It was a fact. I think yes, they wrote an article about such a device in Ham Radio Magazine, how to construct such a device, Dick, over.
Okay. If a person doesn't have access to that device that you're now describing, which is a bit unusual, I think you could wind a sampling coil around your toroid, and the coil you're going to wind is sort of a figure eight winding. In other words, some of the winding, one of the loops of the figure eight is going around the toroid material itself. The other part of the loop is in air, and your grid dip meter is coupling to that air-type coil. See, coupling, because the toroid itself is such an extremely good closed magnetic field device, where the magic of the toroid is that it has almost no leakage reactance, almost no external magnetic field. Therefore, there's very little external energy for the grid dip meter to electronically couple to, and therefore making the measure becomes more difficult. But bear in mind that the toroid itself, ferrite material itself, has a desirable frequency region where it gives you the best performance. The manufacturer will tell you that. But the raw material itself really has no natural resonance. Because in order to have a resonance, you've got to have the equivalent of an inductor, the equivalent of a capacitor. They've got to be coupled together either in parallel or series. And when you study what's going on with a LC network, inductor-capacitor network, that is what we call a resonator, you'll find out that on each half cycle, the stored electronic energy is flipping back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor. If the inductor and capacitor are in parallel with each other, at the instant that sine wave of resonant energy across that circuit takes place, at the instant of peak voltage, by 1/2 CV², almost all of the stored energy is in the capacitor. A quarter of a cycle later, as the voltage is going through 0 volts...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As the applied voltage is going through 0 volts, and the rate of change of voltage, the dV/dt, at 0 volts, is maximum. At that instant of time, the voltage across the capacitor is zero. None of the stored energy is there, but the current through the inductor is maximum. An inductor stores energy as 1/2 LI². If you know the inductance in Henry, and you know the instantaneous current in amperes, L and I, you square the I, you multiply it by L, you divide by 2. That is the stored energy in the inductor at that instant of time in units of joules. 1 joule is a watt second or a newton meter. So joules of energy are flipping back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor on each quarter of the cycle. They flip back and forth twice before you go through a whole cycle. So a real resonator almost always consists of an inductor or an equivalent, a capacitor or its equivalent, and energy flips back and forth between the two. When you wind some number of turns of wire onto your ferrite material, depending on its mu, you end up with a certain amount of inductance. That amount of inductance, when you add a capacitor to it, will give you a resonant frequency. But the raw ferrite material itself, without a coil around it, and without a capacitor or an equivalent stray capacitance connected to that coil, you have no real resonator. I wonder if that helps a little bit, John. KC2WGB and the group K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Great explanation. Yes, it did help. You can go on with Wesley's question, or if you want to go to the next, whatever you'd like to do.
Yeah, your precision high-power amplifier with a gain of 100 sounds like a beautiful piece of equipment. Although it has a funny name, it is my belief it is really an operational amplifier. I cut my teeth way back in the dark ages on a 741 integrated circuit operational amplifier. What is an operational amplifier? It's something which internally has a whole lot of gain, but then you've got a feedback path which is almost always a resistor, or the dominant portion of the feedback path is a resistor. And by the way you set up the input coupling resistor and the feedback resistor, you determine the exact gain of the op amp. The magic about of an op amp is that once you set the resistors you apply to it within its desired frequency region, you know the exact gain you're going to get out of that amplifier, AC-wise and DC-wise, because there's nothing more stable in the world than a high-precision resistor. The amplifier itself, the real tube or transistors that are inside, their gain can go up and down like crazy as a function of temperature, applied voltage, age, and whatever. But if the feedback path is the dominant path, and it's a set of resistors, and the resistors are determining the gain, then with high accuracy, you know the exact gain you're going to get out of an operational amplifier that's so used. These five ceramic tubes, high-power tubes on your amplifier, I think have been set up in such a way that if you study the schematic diagram, I'm guessing it is, there's a feedback path that is dominant in resistance, and it has operational amplifier-like topography. That's my guess. Let me drop. And every operational amplifier has a very good set of known and defined limitations. What's the maximum current the operational amplifier can deliver to the load? The manufacturer will tell you that. What's the maximum peak-to-peak voltage the amplifier will deliver? That's well known. Another thing every operational amplifier has is the equivalent of what you and I would call frequency response, but they give it another name. They call it slew rate. In the case of that old-fashioned 741 operational amplifier, where I used an awful lot of them in the mid-70s in the design of a spectrum analyzer, we put a whole lot of them inside of there to make the sawtooth amplifiers, to make the frequency counters and whatever. That particular old-fashioned operational amplifier had a slew rate of 0.5 volts per microsecond. In other words, I could put a sine wave into it, and let's assume that my operational amplifier, my little transistorized one, was good for 5 volts peak-to-peak, in my example. So I'm putting in a sine wave. I've set it up for a gain of, let's say, 10. I'm getting 5 volts peak-to-peak out when I'm putting from my signal audio signal generator 0.5 volts peak-to-peak input. I'm putting in 0.5 volts peak-to-peak in my example, and I'm getting 5 volts out peak-to-peak. And I started off at 1 kilohertz, and I'll notice that the beautiful sine wave coming out of my Hewlett-Packard Model 200 audio oscillator, Weinbridge audio oscillator, is a beautiful pure sine wave at, say, for instance, 1 kilohertz. And I'll notice that what comes out of the op amp has almost identical quality. Then I grab the knob on the audio oscillator and I start turning up the frequency to higher and higher frequencies. Let me drop. And pretty soon I get up to some frequency, like in the case of a 741 op amp running with 5 volts peak to peak, I'm guessing the number is going to be somewhere in the vicinity of 20 or 30 kilohertz. When I hit something like 20 or 30 kilohertz of sine wave, I'll notice that the input sine wave is beautiful. The output sine wave is starting to take on a peculiar characteristic. At zero crossing, where the maximum slope of the sine wave output should be, all of a sudden, I'm starting to get something that's slowly moving over toward a triangle wave generator. Because it is slew rate limited, in volts per microsecond. As I go to a high enough frequency, no matter what I put in, whether it be a square wave, a sine wave, or whatever, around zero crossing, where I'm asking for the maximum slope of voltage versus time on my oscilloscope to come back out of that op amp, I'll notice that it starts becoming a straight line characteristic. As I said, every op amp has a slew rate limitation. The most severe signal you can put into an op amp, let me drop. The most severe signal you can put in is a square wave. Because at each transition of a square wave, you're asking it to go from maximum negative to maximum positive in essentially zero time. And on the other half of the square wave, you're asking to go in the other direction from maximum positive to maximum negative. You're asking for the extreme in slew rate of volts per microsecond. And as I said, every op amp has some kind of a limitation. Therefore, it's going to start giving you this peculiar characteristic. On top of that, depending on the symmetry of the push-pull output circuit of your operational amplifier, every real operational amplifier has another built-in limitation, and that is the positive going slew rate and the negative going slew rate might be a little bit different, even though the data sheet from the manufacturer didn't tell you that. As such, you put a square wave, a really severe high voltage, high frequency square wave into your op amp, because it can slew in the positive direction with more alacrity than it can the negative direction, you could easily end up with a DC level shift because of its non-symmetric slew rate while you're putting in this severe waveform of a square wave. So these are some of my guesses as to what I think is going on. I wonder if any of this matches your early measurements on this new beautiful piece of equipment, which maybe you picked up today. Over to you first, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, exactly what you're saying. And because of that transition from maximum positive past zero to maximum negative, we had this problem where it would confuse it because it couldn't keep up with that slew rate. But once we gave it a DC offset and placed most of the square wave, all of the square wave above the zero line, then we got exactly the results we were expected to see. The next question was, that DC offset is now going to be represented at the output, and that's where we were looking to make a capacitive coupling circuit to eliminate the DC, but yet try to preserve the square wave. So that's where we were at.
Or, if we keep it exactly at the zero line, John explained that, maybe that it's not needed.
Let me first ask you this question, John. If I took your circuit when you're getting this DC offset with the square wave, and if I lower the amplitude of the square wave, and if I lowered the frequency of the square wave, if I go low enough in frequency and low enough in amplitude, does the input waveform and output waveform track? In other words, when I'm no longer running into as much of the slew rate limitation, at a low enough voltage and a low enough frequency, does the input and output show greater symmetry? Over to you, John.
I'm trying to remember exactly our tests. It seemed to behave itself well within its test of 120 kilohertz. It was when we went above that that it started to get confusing. But we also found out that putting in a square wave, with a normal square wave with no offset, we weren't getting the correct voltages out of the amplifier. Even at minimum, if we were putting in 2 volts, we expected to get 200 out. It wasn't working well until we gave it the offset. Then it was exactly because I felt it's supposed to do DC, positive or negative, it'll do it to G to 1, and it does the DC perfectly. But when we tried, and it performs very well on a sine wave up to a certain point, but when we used the square wave with that slew rate, it just couldn't keep up no matter what we were doing, actually. It was not accurate.
Okay, I just did an interesting experiment. Let me think if I did it right. Let me go back here.
Well, actually, John, we went to 1 megahertz and we had 1140-something with the offset. So it was performing. Maybe I don't understand something. I'm sorry.
I got to guess to what's going on. Let me show you something. You guys are running into a very classic problem that's not common sense. If I was putting in a 120 kilohertz sine wave, and if I was asking for 100 volts of peak-to-peak output, which I think is one of the experiments you guys did, first of all, 120 kilohertz means that each individual sine wave takes up a period of 8.33 microseconds. So 8.33 microseconds is the period. 100 volts on 8.3 microseconds, I could do the calculation. It's a whole lot of volts per microsecond, so to speak. However, the slope of a sine wave as it goes through zero is 2 pi greater than the peak-to-peak voltage, 6.28. If I do that multiplication, a pure sine wave, which is the most gentle waveform you and I can think of, even before we start going to a square wave, a 100-volt peak-to-peak sine wave at 120 kilohertz is asking for a slew rate when it goes through zero, the zero-crossing slew rate. You're asking for 5,000 volts per microsecond, even though you're only asking for 100 volts peak-to-peak, because the frequency at which you're doing it and the amplitude at which you're requesting, and even if it was a pure sine wave, you'd be asking for 5,240 slew rate volts per microsecond. And so very few amplifiers can do that. And if you now start asking for a square wave or a pulse waveform where you even want a greater number of volts per microsecond, you may be running into the slew rate limitation of the amplifier. Before I go too much further, I wonder if some of that made some sense, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it does. It makes perfect sense. And I was just confused with why does it correct itself when we make it a positive going wave by giving it the DC offset. It's still making this, the rise time is the same, and of course the decay time, but the amplifier performs exactly on specs within, I would say, 3%. So that was one of the questions I had. I didn't understand why that made such a difference in that transition. Now, according to your formula, what is happening to that square wave, or even let's say a sine wave, when we give it the positive shift? We bring that negative portion of the wave right up to zero. So now we have no crossing of zero. So now how does that affect the frequency per second?
So when we gave 2 volts RPM, we've got 1147 volts output.
Yeah, let me go back a couple of steps. When you were first testing this precision 100 gain amplifier with at least 100 volts or even more, maybe it's 1,000 volts of output peak-to-peak capability, if you put in a low enough frequency sine wave of low enough amplitude and you change the DC offset of the input voltage, did the output track one-to-one, DC-wise and AC-wise? Is it only when you went to higher frequencies and higher magnitudes that you got this peculiar shift in the output? Is that approximately true, John? Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, I believe that was our observation.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. Therefore, everything you're describing to me sounds like this is an extremely high-power tube-type operational amplifier. It has a different name, made by the Fluke company. Who knows what year it was made? Since it was done with tubes, I'm guessing it's a slightly older instrument. And once you find the data sheet, if you don't already have one, I think you're going to find out that the slew rate
2 meter transmit.
I think you're going to find out that the slew rate limitation in volts per microsecond, or maybe in your case it's kilovolts per microsecond because you've got a real high power amplifier there. I think that is the limitation you're running into. The fact that you go to higher frequencies and or higher amplitudes or more square wave-like waveforms, and then you get this peculiar DC offset. I think it is the non-symmetric slew rate limitation of your high-power op-amp that's causing that effect. That's my best guess as to what you're seeing. And yes, if it does give you the desired waveform that you want at the desired frequency and slew rate, but when you're running your high-power, high-frequency test at 120 kilohertz, I'm guessing you would like to get 120,000 pulses per second out of this thing. The fact that it gives you a DC offset, can you now remove the DC offset with the right kind of a capacitor coupling network? Absolutely. However, now depending on the nature of your load, as you put a real load on the far side of that coupling capacitor, and now you've got a thoroughly symmetric waveform, and in order for that symmetric waveform to drive your load resistor, let me drop.
B2HWW, you want to comment?
How we recognize, in order for your operational amplifier to drive that symmetric waveform that you form by the coupling network on the output into your load resistor, notice what's happening now. Let's assume now that you've got a, I'm going to pick a number, 1,000 volts peak to peak. You've got a waveform that goes 500 volts up above ground and 500 volts below ground on various portions of the waveform. During the time it's 500 volts above ground, if, for instance, I had a one kilo ohm load resistor, I'm asking it to deliver 500 volts, 1 kilo ohm. I'm asking it to deliver 500 milliamps of positive current. And on the other half of the cycle, I'm asking it to deliver 500 milliamps of negative current. Because you're already into the slew rate limitations of the op amp, the fact that you use a coupling capacitor to reestablish the symmetry of the waveform, because the amplifier is already in its limitations, it may not have symmetric current driving capability. That's the next limitation. Every op amp has got a maximum positive current it can deliver, a maximum negative current it can deliver, a maximum positive slew rate it can deliver, a maximum negative slew rate it can deliver. And I think you're now entered well into those limitations. So even with that symmetry created by your coupling network, once you add it, you might not completely be home free yet. And by way of the measurements you guys are going to be doing in the next week, you're going to be finding out more and more about that thing, particularly if you've got the data sheet from the manufacturer, assuming that your tubes are all in good shape. Over to you, John. KC2WBG, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. You filled us in very well, and we will be doing some experimenting, and we definitely will get back to you. Wesley may have a further question, but they've satisfied everything I know. And I know we got to move on, and maybe we can pick up some a little later about the capacitive coupling unit. But you can pass it over to Wesley if he wishes.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Interesting. Well, the device was calibrated and checked before it was sent. I believe that the tubes and everything, ceramic tubes, they are in pristine condition. Although I suspect five tubes, which one is working as a preamp, as a drive, it is a huge amount of power. Now, what we found is that the generator was for some reason showing us over 4 volts, even though that fancy generator is capable of 2 volts to be given. And then we put on the scope and we find out that we have 2 volts exactly RMS. So we move it on this particular generator more to positive. So everything was positive, nothing was negative. My question at that point is, if I have a dead position and I'm only interested with the square poles, do I need a capacitor? Or I don't need a capacitor because it's going at that point to, let's say, 1147 volts, also RMS, not peak to peak. So God knows how many volts is peak to peak. And it is going to zero, but it's not going to minus. Back to you.
B2HWW.
Yeah, we're going to pick you up with in a minute, Howie. Let me drop for long enough.
B2SAY.
And Doug recognized. Let me drop until we get a beep. When you're measuring voltages of, let's say, a sine wave, and you wanted to know the true RMS power, and the sine wave has a zero DC offset, very little problem. When you start adding a DC offset into an AC meter that's measuring true RMS, you now start getting some peculiar readings. A 5-volt DC coming out of a battery would be 5 volts of RMS. 5 volts of peak-to-peak voltage on a sine wave, we have to go through the mathematics of that, but I'm going to guess it's something in the vicinity of a 2 volts of RMS. If I combine the two, if I combine the 5 volts of DC offset with the 2-volt sine wave, common sense would lead you to believe I would have 5 plus 2, 7 volts of true RMS voltage. It's a more complicated formula than that. You go to the formula on what true RMS is, you'll find out it's a more complicated calculation. This operational amplifier, I am guessing, has a positive slew rate current, a slew rate limit, negative slew rate limit, positive current capability, negative current capability, highest frequency capability, and so on. And when you start adding capacitors for both coupling and resonating and peaking and whatever, in order to emphasize your particular performance that you want out of what I think is something like a Tesla coil. Let me drop. Your question now is really, what's the best way to get the right amount of peaking, to get the right amount of performance out of your, let's say, Tesla coil, when it's being fed with this precision amplifier? And that's not a simple one. It's going to take a little more study of finding out the real characteristics of that amplifier, what it's really capable of delivering, what is the nature of your load. Your load is a nonlinear, and so I don't think there are simple answers here yet. But as you guys make more and more measurements, gather more and more data, it's going to become a little bit more clear. I wonder if you've ever worked with a high-power op-amp like that. I think it's an op-amp, Howie. HWW first, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I wanted to answer the question about why they're getting, when they keep this whole square wave or the sine wave above the zero line, where they offset it and they see the amplifier working. You didn't get into the fact of dead zone. At the zero line, you have something called crossover distortion. You can measure that and see what is the voltage. Just because you put in a 0.1, you may not see anything. There's going to be some, depending on the type of output configuration, with maybe two out tubes running class A, B, because it's an op amp, you have feedback around that. That's the first thing. Second, Dick, what they can do is put a square wave in and look for the tilt of the square wave. You put a square wave in, you look at the top, you look at the bottom of the square, across the square wave, and you can take the percentage. If you put a square wave in, an ideal amplifier is going to give you no tilt. So you want to know what the tilt is of that. You put a square wave in, you find out what the tilt is. You can also find out the slew rate, V min to V max, all of that. And also, you want to know what the RMS is, you got to do root mean square. You got to integrate the whole thing. But the bottom line is that at the zero line, you got crossover distortion. So if you keep everything above the zero line, then that's the reason why it's working, because there's probably an area where there's no signal. Go ahead, Dick.
Howie's brought up an interesting point. Up till now, I've been telling you what I think are the limitations of real good operational amplifiers. Positive and negative slew rate voltage limits and current limits and so on. There's also frequency response, and every op-amp does also have a little bit of crossover distortion. In other words, in most transistorized op-amps, you're turning on one set of transistors for the positive half of the waveform, and you're turning on another set of transistors during the negative half of the waveform. And somewhere around the zero crossing, you're asking for a trade-off to take place where one amplifier starts operating and the other amplifier starts operating. And the way that handoff takes place in the circuit, each individual manufacturer has got his favorite way of handling that. Some do it better than others. And therefore, if you put your magnifying glass on the oscilloscope near a zero crossing, every op amp will show you some kind of a slight peculiarity called crossover distortion. And so that sometimes can be tuned out, but it's another factor we've got to worry about here. When it comes to the huge amount of DC offset these guys are getting, I think it's more than crossover distortion that's doing it. I think it's the differential slew rate limitation is my first guess. Doug, I wonder if you've ever run with really high power up amps like this. This sounds like this thing can put out a kilowatt of power. But the A2SAY, I think you're on the eastern input, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Doug.
Hi, Vic. W-A-2-S-A-Y. And yes, I'm on Eastern input. No, I have never worked on an amplifier like that in my life. But I understand that the thing is true. If I'm correct, then what little I know about op-amps doesn't apply. But what I know about op-amps is that the normal semiconductor uses transistors which can pull to the negative supply more or less equally as the NPN transistors can pull to the positive supply. So you have NPNs and PNPs doing the job. Well, there isn't any negative version of a tube. There's no PNP tube. So I'm wondering whether the fact that there is an unequal drive, basically, involved in the operational amplifier may be causing the problem. And when he offsets the thing, maybe he offsets it towards the positive supply, and he's got something to pull it up, and he doesn't need to pull it down so hard, and maybe that's the answer. I don't know. WA2SAY, back to you, Dick. K2RIW to get it.
Very good, Doug. You brought up another very good point. Real transistorized operational amplifiers use a combination of NPN and PNP transistors. So you've got one set of transistors that like operating on positive voltage on their plate, so to speak. And you've got another set of transistors that like operating on negative voltage on the equivalent of their plate. Well, tubes don't have that. So either there's some elaborate internal capacitive coupling network on this operational amplifier, or maybe of the five tubes that are present, one of the tubes is a preamplifier, and the other four tubes are used in pairs. Two of the tubes are used in the positive going direction, operating as a typical plate-coupled amplifier, and the other two tubes maybe are operating as a cathode follower in order to try to make the opposite polarity. So it's quite possible that the amplifier itself, when you study the schematic, you'll be able to discover that it has considerably more current driving capability in, let's say, the positive direction versus the negative direction. And that problem will get more exaggerated as you go to higher frequencies and demand larger output voltages. So quite a bit more study is going to be required. Let's hope that you guys eventually find a owner's manual for that thing, or at least a schematic diagram. And with a schematic diagram that we ship among ourselves, a schematic diagram that we ship among ourselves in the TechNet, I think we're all going to get a lot smarter as to what this thing is capable of doing. My gut feel is it's going to be able to do most of what you guys desire. But, like everything else, it doesn't come easy. You're going to have to learn the idiosyncrasies. Every new piece of test equipment has got its idiosyncrasies, it's got its strong points, its weak points, and once you learn those, you can make very good use of it. We're going to come back to you guys later. The other person who signed in was KC2, let's see now, Rich. Here we go. Almost skipped over you, Rich. N2EO. What's going on in Whitestone these days? K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Left a little long pause there. Good evening, N2EO. Dick, as you know, Barry recently put up a Glenn Martin tower, a 6-meter beam, a 2-meter beam, and we have a 432 beam going up pretty soon on the same tower. Got preamps up there using the column 62S1 with KWM2 on 6 and 2 meters, and I have a transverter on order from Down East Microwave for 432. And what I've been discussing with Barry was the possibility of getting the two of us on 10 gigs, and just wanted to get a feel for it from you, because on 10 gigs the equipment has to go up at the antenna. The losses are so high. I wonder exactly how you handle that, Dick. Let me let it drop. Alright. I've been looking at the stuff that Down East Microwave sells for 10 gigs. Haven't really studied it that closely. But a couple of questions. Most of their stuff they're advertising, you know, the kits for 10 gigahertz to be used on a tripod with a small dish for hilltopping. Have you used any of that equipment and weatherproofed it? And I wonder how you weatherproofed it to get it up on a tower. so it can stay outside. And also, I wonder if there are any problems. I know you said you go up with an IF on 2 meters, I believe. I want to use a KWM-2 on 10 meters. That may be a little bit of a stretch to convert from 10 is an IF up to 10 gigahertz. But I'm just feeling the waters on this, Dick. It's something that I said to Barry. Maybe if we get on, you know, maybe there's some other activity, especially during the contest. And I just wonder, like I say, how to handle a thing like this. K2RIW, TechNet, Limelock, N2EL.
Good set of questions. With reference to 10 gigs, Rich, you and Barry both have the kind of scientific mind which will, in my opinion, definitely enjoy 10 gigahertz. 10 gigahertz is not for everybody. A guy who gets on 20 meters with a CW or a sideband and can make contacts worldwide any time of the day or night when Mother Nature's ionosphere supports him. To him, there's a certain kind of ham radio called 14 megacycle, 20 meter ham radio. And would that particular guy enjoy what goes on at 10 gigs? Quite a few of those guys would not. You and Barry definitely would. So you guys are made for 10 gigs. I operated 10 gigs fairly seriously from 1990 to 2000, roughly. I haven't been as active since then, but I want to get back to it. And I did it all. 95% of my operation was from the top of a 100-foot tower. And my IF was working at 144 megs, so I took a... the German company, can't even think of the name of the company right now, that made the 10 gig transverter.
SSB.
Say again?
SSB, Eric.
You got it. Thank you, Eric. SSB Electronics transverter, popular in that year, and it's still reasonably popular to my knowledge. It requires something like 100 milliamps of drive at 144 megacycles. It's got a 10.224 oscillator, 10.224 gigahertz oscillator, mixes it with 144, giving you 10.368. The correct harmonic of 144 megacycles, all of a sudden I can't think of what harmonic it is. Is it 168? Anyhow, the right harmonic of 144 megacycles falls on exactly 10.368 gigahertz. And although the ham band at 10 gigs runs from 10.0 to 10.5 gigahertz, it's 500 megs wide, everybody gathers at 10.368.100 as the calling frequency. 100 kc into the band. And so, by listening to the harmonic of your 144 megacycle transmitter, you can always find a 10 gigahertz signal. That's one of the reasons why that frequency got settled on by everybody. In my case, I took this transverter, as I said, only had 200 milliwatts of output. It was in a set of boxes that were about 8 inches wide, about 4 inches, 8 inches long, about 4 inches wide, and the combination was about 3 or 4 inches high. Put that into a weatherproof box with some relays and power supplies and whatever, and mounted it at the top of the tower on the back of a 2-foot dish. Let me drop it. So the feed horn on the 2-foot dish came out with a waveguide to coax adapter, which in turn was a piece of semi-rigid coax cable that went into a 3-millimeter connector, an SMA connector. The actual connector that went through my weatherproof box, and my weatherproof box was a little bit less than a cubic foot. And it hung at the top of the tower, had a small weep hole at the bottom, so any moisture that got in had a way to drip back out. So I fed 12 volts up to it in the transmit mode. I fed 144 megacycles at 100 milliwatts up to it. The feed line had relatively low loss at 144 megs, so the signal, it's a tunable IF system, if you know what I mean. As I move 144 to 145 megs, I'm tuning from 10.368 to 10.369 megacycles if I wanted to. Gigahertz, actually, but you know what I mean. So it's sideband, it's a tracking converter, a tunable IF system, and in the receive mode, anything it received on 144 on 10 gigs, it transferred back down to 144. You'll notice that the ratio of 144 to 10 gigs is almost a 100-to-1 ratio. It violates the usual rule for good single sideband, a good super heterodyne design. Let me drop.